Coming up today, how Facebook wants to eat the internet, how wearable devices are helping to diagnose schizophrenia and maybe create hypochondria, and how ancient Egypt is just a big fat liar. All that and more coming up. This is the wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from mock mummies to Facebook fears. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm absolutely freezing.
Yeah, I'm freezing in here too.
I don't know why we need to keep this room at 0 degrees Celsius, but it seems to be the way.
Jeremy likes the product cupboard. Yeah, icy cool.
What do you mean product like cupboard,
like Liat? The pages.
You mean a well-equipped podcast studio.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, yeah.
Orbiting the Earth in our wired podcast studio spaceship.
It keeps us punchy.
I thought I needed to continue the tradition I established last week and deliver some more forced tech humour. So this is my joke for the week. Are you ready?
I think so.
Right. A policeman pulls Werner Heisenberg over on the Autobahn for speeding. The policeman says, "Sir, do you know how fast you were going?" And Heisenberg replies, "No, but I know exactly where I am." Kaboom! That is some excellent fun right there. Keeping the jollity on this podcast at a very high level,
I think. It's inclusive humour, isn't it?
It's funny because I didn't actually hear you laughing.
Well, yeah. We didn't have time. It was it was drowned out by your kaboom.
Yeah, your self-congratulatory.
Well, I don't know if you've
Michael
ever seen...
Michael is funny.
There's a comedian called Nick Helm has a very good unpronounceable show on BBC Three right now, I think. And he just basically says kaboom after every joke and launches an explosion of fire. So I'm kind of very much taking that as my model.
Maybe we could use some kind of sound effect to mimic that.
That's very up to you in the editing suite.
Okay.
But I would appreciate it. That's all for now. Let's get on with the news. So we are now in a post-election world. And there's been some big news for tech and science this week, because obviously we had a very significant reshuffle. So we thought, as a first news item, we might just kind of breeze through some of the more significant appointments for tech and science in the UK. So as I said, we've got new secretaries of state for energy and climate change and business, and new ministers for science and other business-related environments. And some of them are very significant and some very surprising. Did any of the names particularly stick out for you guys?
Joe Johnson, after his father was publicly quoted as saying, "I don't think my son knows anything about science." Welcome, the new science minister.
To be fair, I mean, in his CV... there really isn't any science. He's a very accomplished individual in some ways, and a very policy-minded policy wonk, I think, is the the phrase. But he's a first-class history graduate, former journalist, former investment banker, I think, but not actually anything to do with science. He's very much more from the higher education end of the science and universities brief.
But he can read and write very well.
He can.
I do always find it a bit strange, though, when they seem to match up people with departments in a way that doesn't really reflect their expertise. And, you know, there is a lot of expertise in government. That's the way that, you know, people end up kind of standing for to be elected in the first place. You know, they generally have some kind of background in something or another. And you would think that the government could perhaps think of a way to use that expertise by matching people with departments. But no.
Well, science particularly is one that's kind of been on people's minds, because the science minister before the previous incumbent, David Willetts, was widely regarded as an excellent science minister. Mm-hmm. Whatever place you put yourself on the political spectrum, he was very well regarded by researchers and science institutions. Greg Clark, who took over from him for the last year, I think it's fair to say, not so warmly received. But Joe Johnson, somewhat of an unknown quantity. He's most of the early controversy, if you can call it that, around his appointment has focused on the fact that he believes foreign students should not count towards any kind of immigration cap, which could be significant in terms of research and universities, but again, not specifically for science. So we're kind of waiting to see what Joe Johnson will be as a science minister.
That's a way of bringing more money into the country.
That's true.
And
into education.
More expertise.
But on the other hand, you know, one of the big things for all research institutions is money. So... any way to make that slightly easier, perhaps, would be a good thing. But we'll have to kind of wait and see. I think the most controversial appointment that's of relevance to us, although perhaps in a more peripheral way, is John Whittingdale as the new Culture Secretary, principally because of the comments he's made in the past around the BBC, which, I everyone knows about these at this point, and they're not new comments, but very much seen in opposition to the current status quo on the BBC licence fee. And the BBC, obviously, is a hugely important player, not only for media, but for technology. There are lots of different technology projects throughout the history of the BBC that have really made a big difference. And obviously, the BBC is a huge player online as well. So I have to kind of wait and see what happens with that. Negotiations are happening and scheduled to conclude on the licence fee by the end of 2017.
But he's basically proposed, well, in the past, has said that the fee should be proportionate to your income.
That's the gist.
Yeah.
I mean, he also believes, and I think action on this may come sooner than 2017, that not paying the license fee shouldn't be a criminal act, that it should be to some extent voluntary, and also determined by actually using the services, particularly online, rather than having a television set.
Yeah.
Because obviously,
if you're using it more.
Yeah, and just because you have a television doesn't necessarily mean you're using BBC services anymore in a way that wasn't always true. Mm.
So that's the BBC, and obviously that's just one part of British culture. How about other areas of British culture that perhaps, you know, Wired touches on, sort of video games and the arts as well?
Well, games is an interesting one. Both the UK trade bodies on video games, so that's UKIA and TIGA, or TIGA, have welcomed the appointment, although it's hard to tell. It's hard to read through the lines of their statements. Mm. So obviously they have a vested interest in working with the minister or the secretary of state in this case. And they also have, you know, some vested interest in terms of tax breaks
right.
and making sure they get a good deal from the government. And, you know, so it's hard to tell. They're not going to release a statement that's blasting the new secretary of state immediately after his appointment. But it has been, generally speaking, warmly received by that area of the media. Mm. And as you said, it's a wide portfolio that he has to work on. Press regulation is another area that he's seen as obviously quite right wing on, as he is in terms of his voting record and all kinds of other social issues which aren't necessarily directly related to culture and to what we do. But it's going to be interesting to see how he treats ongoing negotiations around press regulation. He's been seen as saying that the Leveson inquiry went far beyond its boundaries. So again, it may spell some interesting manoeuvres in that area too.
Mm. And are there any other particular ministers that or secretaries of state that are standing out to you?
Well, we obviously had appointment of a new business secretary, Sajid Javid, but that's another very broad brief. The one that sticks out is Amber Rudd as Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change. The interesting thing with her is if you Google her and her opinions on climate change before the appointment, you'll get the quote that says she's very much a Thatcherite when it comes to climate change, which, again, might raise worries. But actually, from her perspective, Margaret Thatcher was one of the world's first leaders to recognise climate change as an issue that was both man-made and could be dealt with by collective government action. And so Amber Rudd has been widely, again, applauded as an appointment. She's a business-focused person and obviously has a bias towards private companies being the solution to climate change as opposed to government. But she's someone who is not a climate change skeptic and, you know, I think will work well with green charities, green businesses to try and address some of the wider problems. I mean, one of the big issues around this in the UK is not so much renewable energy, but nuclear energy. There's been an ongoing controversy around the building of a new nuclear plant. And she seems like someone who will help those negotiations move forward.
Unsurprisingly, most of the appointments, new ministers, have a real focus and background on business and economics, coming from a party that has basically said it's going to save the country by having a strong economy. And when you look through all the kind of top line things that they're talking about, it's monetary things with basically, let's let in more foreign students, good fees for university system. Let's change the BBC fees. Let's join up businesses with, you know, all these climate change initiatives. But generally in our remit, not too bad.
Well, I mean, I think it's early days, and and obviously with all of these kind of appointments, it's events, dear boy, that that tend to make a difference as opposed to someone's background when they come in. And it's always impossible, I think, to tell if a minister or a secretary of state is going to be good at their job in the first few days after they take over. But, you know, there are some brighter signs around the horizon for tech and science that in the past there have been some appointments in that area in the last 5 years that haven't been so warmly received. So it's, generally speaking, good things, I think.
When we compare it to the Equality Minister, Minister for Equality, who apparently voted against gay marriage, I think at least there's some hope. Some correlation between these ministers and their roles.
Well, that's true. I mean, but I think we're kind of coming at this, at least today, from a non-party perspective.
Yes.
I mean, we're past the election, and I think for a lot of trade bodies, private companies, charities and pressure groups and think tanks, they now basically have to regard the minister as just a person they're working with rather than a person from a party or sort of partisan background. And most of the people I've spoken to within business trade bodies and climate change bodies off record seem fairly pleased by those announcements. I think the culture announcement is obviously more controversial where it relates to the BBC. But in kind of pure business and climate change terms, I think they've been more positively received. Liat, in terms of private companies making a difference in health, you've written an interesting story this week around schizophrenia and wearable technology.
Yes. Well, this is actually, it's come out of a unit that's based in the Maudsley South London Hospital, which is connected to King's College London. It's the Bioinformatics Core. Wonderful name for a wonderful group, which basically brings together clinicians, software engineers, data analysts, all sorts, to see if they can find patterns in these huge data sets that they've got access to and create new interventions through technology.
And in this case, it's consumer technology in terms of Fitbit rather than medical wearables created specifically for the task.
Yes, it is, Michael. this team has essentially it's about studying the sleep patterns of schizophrenia patients, which is something that it's very well reported that sleep disturbance can predate a relapse. And they've decided to use Fitbit rather than a medical device to track the sleep patterns of 20 volunteers that they're recruiting now and they're going to be studying over the next couple of months. And a lot of people use Fitbit, obviously, to track their fitness, but also their sleep patterns, how many hours sleep they got, how well rested they were. And when this team compared it to medical devices, they said, actually, it does loads of similar things, but costs a fraction of the price. I think it's something like a third of the price of the medical alternative. And it has Bluetooth. Yay, we can create an app. So they've created an app to track the patterns.
It seems like that's a really kind of good, almost endorsement for Fitbit there, because
a lot of these
wearables compete against each other, and there's a lot of debate as to how accurate they are and the kind of data they're producing. But you know, if they're saying that they're the same, if not better than medical grade wearables that cost a heck of a lot more usually, then that is a really, you know, ringing endorsement for them.
Well, we have to also take it in the context in which it's being experimented with, and that is that this is a pilot study. And part of it is going to be about validating whether Fitbit is suitable for
right.
this. I mean, they believe it is. But on top of that, part of the reason I think they've chosen Fitbit is because they've been talking with Fitbit's developers for ages and have access to the API that allows them to have real-time access to all the data, kind of minute by minute, plugged into their servers, which people don't normally have, so that they can track the minutiae instantly. And, you know, so that's where this relationship has come from. Fitbit likes to work with different businesses and research groups to allow that sharing of data.
When we talked about this as an editorial team, again, as an outsider, one of the obvious questions was whether this could also cause problems, because, I think each of us, when we've tried wearables, there's a certain amount of paranoia that also comes from having a heart rate monitor or a sleep monitor. You know, I think anecdotally, some of us have tried sleep monitoring before and actually found it harder to get to sleep because you're more aware of what you're doing. So what do they say as to those concerns?
I asked the team about it, and one of the physicians heading it up, who is a psychiatrist, he said not at all. He really thinks the opposite is the case with this. I know that obviously schizophrenia patients suffer from paranoia more than, you know, the average Joe. and has, you know, potentially obsessive tendencies, depending on what kind of psychosis they're experiencing. But he was saying, no, this will empower them. It will put their, you know, control over their own health, which is something you just, you know, you must feel very powerless if you're diagnosed with a disorder like this and you're told that your sense of reality is not accurate and take this medication, you're going to be fine. That's incredibly disconcerting on many levels. Mm. And you have no control. You're just told by someone who has, you know, a degree, this is what you have to do. And you don't have any real proof because it's, you know, very hard to understand with mental illnesses. That's someone's perspective of the world. They think it's right. They think it's normal until someone intervenes and says, this isn't normal behavior. You need it corrected. Whereas with this, you can see the data in front of you. You can see, oh, you know, I'm experiencing more paranoia today. And actually, the data on this SleepSight app that's going to my physician is saying that I've had really disturbed sleep patterns. Or, you know, things like a lot of issues with people that have mental illnesses is that they'll stop taking medication. It might not make them feel good. They might feel paranoid about why they're taking it, who's making them take it. And a lot of people stop taking it. And if you can see immediately the data showing that stopping taking your medication, drinking alcohol, having disturbed sleep patterns, whatever, it is building to you towards a relapse, then you know, you have all this evidence at your hands and you have so much more agency over your own fate and your own health.
And this is also an example, as we've spoken about, in different areas over the last few weeks that could save the NHS money despite an initial investment.
Yes, hopefully that is the grand plan that the team has. They know that all across the health services, you know, teams are completely overstretched and there's an awful lot of work going into how we can work on preventative healthcare with aging population and, you know, more and more people suffering from things like heart disease or neurodegenerative disorders that put a huge burden on the health services. And we just don't have the manpower and money at the moment, despite what everyone said at the general election. They don't. And particularly in Southeast London, they're quite overstretched. You know, it's a really busy centre at the Maudsley Hospital. They have 5,000 patients a year and it's not a big place. So the idea eventually is that once this concept has been proven, you can create an early warning system which, you know, as it's tracking the sleep patterns and creates a sleep signature for each individual, there can be an alert sent to a physician saying there's something going on here, you need to see them now, and hopefully actually catch, you know, the relapse before it happens. But also, I mean, it is unfortunate that there isn't the manpower to have strong enough community ties, it sounds like, between the physicians, the nurses and the people that are suffering from some of these disorders. One of the doctors I spoke to said when someone has their first episode, they're pretty much sent back into the community straight away as soon as possible. And, you know, you just, that's it. You've lost that connection. You're dependent on that person coming back to you and saying, I need help again, or whatever it is. But if there were a way, you know, it's not ideal, you'd rather probably see someone once a week and talk to them face to face, but to have a kind of, you know, an alert system that is making sure that there is that tie still between the services and the individual, that's really concrete and has lasting benefits.
Katie, disturbing revelations this week about the ancient Egyptians.
That's right. So ancient Egyptians have long been known for mummifying their dead. And this actually includes not only humans, but their beloved pets as well. Unfortunately, a discovery that has been made public this week has found that hundreds of animal mummies are actually completely empty.
Wait a minute. They're not completely empty.
Well, they are not. They do not contain animal remains of any type.
They just shoved some other stuff in there.
Exactly.
That they found lying around.
So how is this explained?
So basically, for the very first time, it's actually the University of Manchester and Manchester Museum have scanned over 800 animal mummies. And these include things from crocodiles to birds and, of course, to Egypt's highly revered cats. We all know that cats play a very important part in ancient Egyptian culture. And they've used x-rays and CT scans and actually discovered that inside these mummified bundles, they have kind of sometimes bits of twigs and bits of mud and all sorts of things, which suggests perhaps that, you know, this isn't necessarily. There could have been some kind of dodgy practices going on. So around a third of the mummies that have been found don't contain any animal material at all. So at this stage, you would expect sort of still to be able to see skeletal remains in there. And instead, they found the not only kind of mud and sticks, but eggshells and feathers. Now, although it seems like initially they thought perhaps there was something kind of going on here where the embalmers were just kind of
robbing people blind.
Exactly. What they've actually thought now is maybe that it's not as dodgy as it might seem. They might not have been scamming people, but instead using materials that were associated with animals. So they were just using anything that they could find that the animals had kind of touched or been, you know, had used during their lifetimes.
That sounds like a good thing to me, because I can't remember what the number was. It was something insane, like 70 million animal mummies have been found. Or the Egyptians mummified 70 million. Something like that. Something, I mean, whatever. It's a horrifying number.
You can find
number.
The exact details Google on wired.co.uk.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's crazy, really, because, I mean, so humans were always mummified in order to preserve their bodies for the afterlife. That's kind of a recognised thing. Whereas animal mummies are actually kind of highly prized religious offerings. And there was such demand for these animals that, you know, they almost had industrial scale operations going on to breed the animals in sort of breeding farms. And quite a lot of them were killed while they were still quite young in order to, you know, achieve this kind of turnover of animals that they had. So it was
so basically like the meat industry today.
Yeah. But rather than, I mean, so, you know, there are debates, ethical debates there about, you know, the usefulness of killing animals for their meat. Like, this was literally just
what do you mean, this is for someone's eternal happiness? this is
yes,
surely,
of course,
they are beautiful things as well. I mean,
really,
you know,
beautiful.
In the British Museum there are a whole bunch of them, and it's weird to see them now because obviously they're in a museum cabinet and it's just a bizarre object, and they look exactly like mummies except they have the heads of cats or whatever, but they are beautiful things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny that this comes up though, because I remember reading a fascinating story, I think it was in the New Yorker, about animal burying animals in the modern world and how people have their pets cremated almost by default now in the States. But studies have shown that the ashes you get back often have nothing to do with your pet.
They're just a random mix of ashes, aren't they?
Yeah, so again,
they just chuck all the animals in together.
Yeah, and I forget exactly where the study was done or the article was produced, but they sent in a plastic cat and got back a bag of ashes of like dogs and stuff. But I think it is one of those things that it's often about, I know this isn't really pets, but it's about the peace of mind or the representation of something rather than the physical remains of something. So, yeah.
Well, and also don't feel disheartened if your pet cremated. I had a friend who once worked at a pet crematorium on the reception desk. And, you know, I think all practices there were very above the board.
Whatever happened to just burying it in the back garden?
Well,
you've
got to remember that, like, some animals, you know, you can't bury, like, huge animals necessarily in the back garden.
You also got to bury them very deep.
Yeah. And, you know,
to make sure that
they don't interfere with the water and that kind of thing. Mm. You know, there's quite a lot of regulation about it, and, you know, you have to make sure that you dispose of my back garden is full of hamsters in shoe boxes. Yeah.
A shoebox is a bad idea.
Well, you know, it just seemed like the right thing to do at the time.
I'm sure, as we speak, an artisanal mummification place is opening up in East London.
Indeed.
Hipster mummification for your pets and beloved other animal
that
creatures.
That would be so cool. Well, mantelpiece.
No, but what do you call it?
Taxidermy
is a huge thing in the hipster communities.
That's true.
I know someone who has a penguin. Like a full life-size emperor penguin. It costs about 400 quid.
I went to a really disturbing shop in the Mission District of San Francisco, which is quite a cool area. There are lots of kind of interesting shops around there. But it was a shop that was dedicated to really fascinating taxidermy, where they'd kind of dressed up little mice and arranged them in scenes and all sorts of things. And they were much bigger animals as well. But yeah, it's an interesting practice. But it just shows that perhaps some of the mummification that used to go on in ancient Egypt isn't quite so strange as it seems.
But this is the thing with taxidermy, is that, like, although it looks like you're preserving an animal, you're actually creating a sculpture. Like, the, you know, most of the animal isn't there anymore. You know, it's really just a kind of a a structure around which you put bits of the animal as
just like with the mummies. Yeah, not much animal there anymore, but it's about creating something beautiful.
Just
that
another
can
instance
be a
in
gift.
Which us and the yeah. ancient Egyptians closer than you think. So our final news item today, Google has some news on its self-driving car program, which may or may not allay some of your fears depending on how you feel about self-driving cars. So statistics from California's Department of Motor Vehicles this week revealed that four self-driving cars, three of which are owned by Google and one owned by a company called Delphi, which supplies parts to the car industry, have been involved in accidents in the last 8 months. After which point, Google, who has been testing cars for 6 years in different types, revealed their full statistics and said that 11 self-driving cars have been involved in property damage only accidents in the last 6 years, which doesn't sound like very much.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
Wait,
but
it was
just
11 out of how many?
48? Well, the 11 accidents in the last 6 years. Google has a fleet, I think, of 27 self-driving SUVs.
Yeah.
And this is over 1.7 million miles of driving.
Okay.
Because obviously these cars are driving in some cases more than you would drive on average. So this is where it gets complicated. So the rate of Google self-driving car accidents is 0.3 damage-only accidents per 100,000 miles, which is less than half the US national average. The problem is that most damage-only or many damage-only accidents, which are usually rear-ending or scraping the car or some other kind of light damage, either don't go reported, but obviously because Google has reported all of them, so it's hard to tell whether you know, they are more in line with the average figures or less in line with the average figures. But either way, what Google said is that all of those accidents really were caused by humans.
Oh, right.
And this
of course.
Is the point.
Of course they were Google.
Well, but I think what they're saying, which I think is true, is that already self-driving cars tend to be safer on average than human drivers. The problem comes in the interaction between humans and robot drivers.
So they're saying these things have occurred when humans have started intervening when they shouldn't.
Yeah. So there's a blog post by Google's head of self-driving cars, which is obviously the kind of job title you get inside Google these days, a man named Chris Urmson. And he has some interesting specific examples where at one point, one of Google's self-driving cars was confronted by two vehicles at once driving on the wrong side of the road at an intersection.
Wow.
And so, but obviously this is a problem because a self-driving car AI has to be able to deal with that kind of situation. I think in that case, it did. It managed to keep the occupants. And I think in this case, there are always occupants in these cars safe. But those are the kind of things that happen on the roads. You know, the roads are crazy. So until we have all self-driving cars, the problem is probably going to come in the interaction between them.
But also testing them in urban environment, these are all damage only, no people involved, but generally Google's tests have not involved any area where there's going to be any human beings that could be injured.
No, they have, absolutely.
What, in urban environments?
Yeah, so around Mountain View, which is where Google is based in California, these cars are driving on public roads. And that's, I think, why the Department of Motor Vehicles released these statistics, because they've been on public roads since September 2014 when they started issuing these licenses. And I think overall it's around 50, maybe slightly less than 50 cars of different companies which are driving around Mountain View in public at the moment. They tend to have human occupants, I think, who can take over in an emergency. But, you know, generally speaking, these cars are doing it themselves. But what they're learning is vital information about how to deal with human drivers. I think what becomes more complicated for the car industry and the insurance industry is how this stuff is treated in practice. So say you're in a self-driving car, someone rear-ends your self-driving car. Whose fault is it? Who's liable? How do you share details? You know, it's a weird situation. And also the fact is that if self-driving cars look like, and it does look like inevitably they're going to be a part of our lives at some point in the next, say, 50 years, if you're being conservative, someone's going to die, right? There are going to be injuries. There really are. And this is going to be an inevitability. If you have these cars driving millions of miles on the roads, even in early testing, someone's going to get hurt.
Especially on motorways.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, because unexpected things happen on the roads.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see what the public reaction to that is. I think we all instinctively and statistically know that driving is a very dangerous thing, and that people get injured fairly regularly on the roads. Self-driving cars aren't going to be immune from that. So as to how the industry reacts, it's going to be interesting.
But we also kind of instinctually trust that the reason this is happening is because it's going to be safer. I mean, that's the promise is that it's going to be safer. So you would, you know, we think it's going to be the magic solution, and that a self-driving car will have the savvy in those bizarre situations that a human driver won't, and the reaction times that a human driver won't.
It's just difficult, isn't it, when you think about the fact that, as Michael said, there will be accidents and people will get hurt at some point or another. Like, the general tendency is to be able to kind of, and even in a law sense, but also in a legal sense, but also just between, you know, a driver and a passenger and whoever, there's an element of blame that always kind of is apportioned when it comes to accidents, and not being able to say, oh no, it was this person, it was this person's fault, like this person should kind of take the blame for this. And, you know, how do you do that when you're talking about things that are, you know, it's not an individual?
Is it the company's responsibility or the person who's sitting in the car that they bought from a company and trusted?
Mm.
And also just ethically and morally, I think people find it easier to ascribe blame to an individual rather than to understand that a kind of a cloud-based AI wasn't able to save someone's life, or may have even been directly responsible.
Especially as you can always take over. Sorry, the driver can always take over if they choose to.
In these current tests,
that could always.
But as to what a commercial argument. Self-driving car could be,
there would have to be an override, surely.
I don't think so. Not necessarily. I mean, again, it depends what kind of system you have. But I think ultimately, with self-driving cars, the promise of them is not only that they're safer because cars are talking to each other and can respond to that information that they're communicating very, very quickly, but that by making them safe in that way, you can remove all of the safety features and make the car about three times as light, which means you have to use a lot less fuel, which means they're more efficient, which means we don't kill the planet. So, like, and they're cheaper. So, you know, there are key benefits to making self-driving cars almost infallible, but the reality is nothing is infallible. So although these are just damage-only accidents and it's a relatively low number, you know, someone in California had to deal with the situation of being in an accident with a robotic car, and it's something that's going to come up more and more. So interesting to see what Google statistics are, but that at the moment they're being fairly transparent with the reality of their early tests. And again, this is all somewhat down the line, and will involve big infrastructure changes on a municipal level, on a national level, and a business level. But we'll see. We'll watch this space, I guess. That's all the news this week. Still to come, Facebook wants to take ever greater control over content on the internet, but are publishers and journalists willing to play ball?
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So, Lias and Katie, we work for a lovely publisher, Condé Nast, and wired.co.uk, an independent website. But in the future, it may turn out that we're working for Facebook, at least to some extent. So
we're all slaves to the machine in some way, Michael.
So what this relates to is an announcement by Facebook of a new feature called Facebook Instant Articles. It's basically a new service by which publishers are working directly with Facebook to post full articles within the service rather than just posting links to their content on an external website. The idea essentially is that articles will load directly in Facebook like a long status update with embedded images, nice looking maps, videos, GIFs and everything else that you come to expect from a media-rich online story. For readers, you know, there's an obvious win because articles load much, much quicker. They require less browser management. You don't have to go to a browser and then come back to Facebook. And for publishers, basically you get to publish where people are, which is on Facebook. There's 1.2 billion of them. And you get to share the revenue. So you can sell both your own advertising and Facebook will sell advertising on your content if you ask them to and share the revenue. To some extent, this seems like a win-win, But for many other people, it's very controversial because it looks more and more like Facebook is taking or wants to take control of almost the entire internet. So like, how do you feel about the fact that kind of Facebook wants to not only link to but host your content?
Well, for one, let's not beat around the bush. Making money in publishing is tough. So first instinct is that anything that helps grow the business and support the business and have a wider readership potentially and have an economic benefit, which means you can keep doing fun, cool things, could be good.
Well, I think that tends to be, I think, at least initially where I come down on it. So I wrote an editorial on the website, which has generated some discussion, even amongst inside the office, about how this kind of thing might lead in the future to changes in how people produce content, and Wired and Condé Nast as a whole is not one of the publishers which is going through this initial test. It's just a few publishers, I think, BuzzFeed, The New York Times, National Geographic, all of which tend to produce very image-heavy graphic content, as we do. But so we're not involved yet. But I guess my feeling on it is, that the history of media generally teaches us that when it comes to something like this, if you regard it with fear and suspicion and don't do anything with it and basically hold back, then someone who's 20 years old is going to come along and do it anyway, do it better than you and kind of replace you. And like, I think we're all of an age where we became journalists at a time where we knew more about social media and Google and HTML than the 40-year-old guys who are running magazines. And now there are 20-year-olds who know things that we don't. And unless we kind of except that there's an idea here, a germ of an idea, which is interesting as well as potentially troubling, we're going to miss out.
I'm deeply suspicious. It's not that I totally disagree with it, because I think that would be foolish, and to write it off like that is not something that I would ever do, I don't think. But I am worried about the idea that, Facebook is... It's almost like Facebook has seen that it's providing a sort of a service to publishers in a certain way, and that it's a way for those publishers to share their content and to get their stuff out there, to get people back to their websites, basically resulting in advertisers paying money to them. And Facebook has seen this and said, we want a share of this publishing revenue, and like there's not a lot to go around, and it does concern me that Facebook is not content with just being a sharing platform, and I think as well that publishers shouldn't have to rely solely on one platform to be its primary source of getting traffic and getting advertising revenue and that kind of thing as well.
I don't think there's a danger that that will ever be the case, because yes, Facebook wants to dominate everything, but is Facebook going to dominate all the demographics? It's not. We already know that younger generations don't use it as much.
I think that that's changing. I think in terms of Facebook demographic, I think if you look at the breakdown of Facebook, it's changed dramatically. But there are a mass, everybody is using it. In every demographic category, there are people using Facebook.
I mean, I think the reality, though, is that we are dependent on Facebook, not us specifically as Wired, but publishing in general. I mean, if you look at the figures of how much referral traffic comes from Facebook, at any of the major publishers, whether that's Gawker or the New York Times, the BBC or HuffPost or whatever, Facebook is a huge part of that already. And every publishing brand spends a huge amount of time, resources and money trying to attract people on Facebook. I mean, to some extent, we're dependent on it. But the reason for that, I think, is not that Facebook is evil necessarily, but that people want to be on Facebook. And like, this is one of the things I spoke about in the piece, was that, Facebook is full of life and people and energy because that's where people love to be. People use Google as well, and Google is another place where similar debates have come up in the past, although I think the major difference is that Google hadn't offered to both share revenue with publishers and allow publishers to sell their own advertising alongside their content on that service, which Facebook is allowing. But we are dependent on Facebook to some extent, and any kind of closer integration with that, I think there are a lot of publishers are going to go for it. And eventually, I think, journalists too, because that's where people are going to read stories. I mean, it's already where people discuss stories. You see Facebook comments below, you know, so many different publishers have now integrated Facebook as their comment system rather than having an old forum, which is kind of the old model. And that is, to some extent, the reality.
But where this could be a good thing is that, yes, everyone wants to be on Facebook and we know how important it is to our traffic. But, you know, then there was a kind of flurry of really similar clickbaity headlines and stories that would populate everyone's Facebook feed once they realized that the BuzzFeed type format worked really well and everyone started copying it, and then Facebook changes its algorithm, blah, blah, blah. But if Facebook created something genuinely, you know, good looking and you could have more interesting features, then it changes the game a little bit, rather than everyone chasing for just someone to click on a completely misleading headline. Perhaps, you know, people start to learn that actually, yeah, this publication always has really beautiful content on Facebook with really interesting, you know, it depends how they do it. It depends what they do with your content. If they're automating this and you think it looks rubbish, maybe well, you're not so and happy because you're giving that control to them.
But it draws in another story that we wrote about on the site this week, which was about the suspicion many people have that Facebook's algorithm can determine the political stance of the articles you see. And I mean, we always hear about Facebook being an echo chamber, so that if you lean one way politically or you have certain interests, you only see that type of article. But this study, which admittedly was done by Facebook, so isn't necessarily reliable, kind of showed that it's really more about us. It's who you surround yourself with and the types of friends you have, more than their algorithm kind of only showing you what you want. And, you know, but again, I think the concern and like the headache is not knowing how the algorithm works, and being dependent on it, which does give up a huge amount of control.
I think that's one of those things that's really going to have to be sorted out in terms of making sure that this is an equal partnership, not just between Facebook and publishers, but between how Facebook treats publishers. Because if it's going to, say, if it's going to prefer certain partners and promote certain content, and I'm not saying that it necessarily would, but there needs to be some kind of oversight system for publishers to be sure of that before they use this platform. And they need to be open about their algorithms and how they work, because otherwise, you know, publishers rightly will be suspicious.
I mean, the other debate it sort of brings in is around Facebook and internet.org, which is their free internet service, which is being trialed in different parts of the world, particularly in Asia, I think, Southeast Asia and India. Where Facebook has been criticized for kind of appearing to cross over the line in terms of net neutrality, that this free service only allows you access to certain websites, which Facebook is determining. And the point being that for many people, Facebook is the internet, particularly in countries like Indonesia, where I think in a recent survey of several thousand people, only 2 out of 10 said they use the internet, but 3 out of 10 said they use Facebook. And Facebook is... Yeah. You know, increasingly indistinguishable from the web, at least, rather than the internet. And but again, I think there is an analogy there for publishers, which is like in the mid-90s and the late-90s, people were hesitant to be on the internet because their content was in print and they didn't want to give up their control to the internet. That was how they saw it. If Facebook were to become analogous with the web or with the internet, you'll probably have to be there to some extent. You know, maybe not solely publishing all of your content on Facebook and giving Facebook a cut, but at least preparing to engage with it rather than close yourself off from it. And I think, as Liat said at the start, making money with publishing is always traditionally been difficult, you know, regardless of whether it's on the internet or in newspapers. It's always been a volatile business. But if there is a new opportunity, I can see why someone like the New York Times, BuzzFeed, or the BBC is different because of the advertising question, perhaps. Whether or not BBC Worldwide is involved, I'm not particularly sure, outside of the UK. But, you know, I can see why they would want to get involved.
We're all trusting that it's going to work and going to look good, and that might not necessarily be the case.
It does look good. I have seen it. It's cool. But it's iOS only at the moment. It doesn't work on the web. So there are limitations. And also it's fair to say that Facebook has tried similar stuff before and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, it's been slow and clunky and hasn't been a great user experience. So.
And they're fairly brutal. You know, if they show it to users and users don't like it, they'll cancel it.
I just want to make sure that, you know, it seems like, especially through internet.org, Facebook for many people is the gateway to the internet in the same way that, you know, Google is for others. And if that's going to be the case, then I'm still a little bit suspicious about the kind of the partnerships here and preferential treatment and exactly how much control Facebook is going to have over the publishing industry as a whole, as a private company. I think, you know, in order to, you know, understand the role that it's going to play in terms of kind of being a service and a public service and something that's really important to everyone, I think the publishing industry also needs to make demands of Facebook too and not be afraid to make demands.
It's true, although I mean, again, one of the interesting wrinkles is, like, we've gotten used to the idea of publishing being like a very meritocratic kind of open place, but that hasn't always really been true. I mean, look at the power of W.H. Smith's as a newsagent. For a magazine to be in Smith's in the mid-90s versus not being in Smith's was life or death, right? Or where you were placed on the rack in Tesco's. I know the old Lads Mag thing, like, really kind of affected a lot of people's business by placing Lads Mags on the top shelf rather than on the bottom shelf. And, you know, this is not a new thing for publishers to have to confront someone who is more powerful than them. I think the frustration for publishers must be that they had an opportunity fairly early on in the life of the internet to be Facebook rather than to just be a publisher, and that kind of hasn't happened for everyone. So, you know, we'll have to kind of wait and see, but, you know, it's an interesting project and just depends on how readers react, I suppose. Just time for some feedback and then a new feature on the podcast, which is a quiz, Katie and Liat, between you two. I've decided we're a bit too nice here and I think it's time to really make you face off. There's not really a prize necessarily, just a kind of an awareness of your knowledge of Wired. But we'll get there. First, just some feedback. This comes from Niels, who says, thanks for a great show. Great to have Liat back. We agree. Just a humble request. Try not to say OK Google on the podcast. My phone did really funny things while I was driving and listening to the show.
I love it. Well, it's good to see an automated assistant actually doing its job for once.
Well, you've just scuppered him again.
Yeah, that's true.
Just hang on. OK Google, play Taylor Swift. Boom. And finally, from Michael, just one small correction. Last week, we were talking about Shazam. We mentioned it as an East London-based company. Obviously, we were wrong. Shazam is actually based in West London, in Hammersmith, not in East London, which he says was curious, given the whole tech city thing, which I think is fair. But it's a lot cheaper to be based in Hammersmith than Shoreditch, I think.
Is Michael you?
No. No, I'm not correcting myself yet.
By writing into the podcast.
Although this was James, and James is off sick today, so I think this is only fair punishment that he learned about this by a third party.
This quiz is just a way to reprimand us for having not read the whole of Wired magazine yet.
Right, so this is the inaugural Wired magazine quiz. Wired's June issue is out on the stands now. It's a great issue. It's focused around Uber and lessons we can learn from the transformative taxi service. I've decided to pick out five details from the magazine and just see how closely the podcast team have read it. and so these are varying questions. We'll go through one by one and then we'll just kind of rack up and see how you do. So
I've not read it yet.
This is from an article, Dust Anyone, about how NASA tracks dust as it blows from Sahara.
Okay.
How many tons of phosphorus is deposited in the Amazon each year? Now, this is the first closest correct answer.
Okay.
How many tons of phosphorus a year deposited in the Amazon?
50 million.
Is that your answer? 50 million.
I'm going to go with 500,000.
The answer is 22,000 tons of phosphorus deposited in the Amazon each year. That's one to Katie. So,
even though
I've
I was still way off.
I've got a very dystopian version of you.
All those
we
million
all
tons
dead.
Of phosphorus.
Question two. This is from an opinion piece in the Ideas Bank by journalist Dinesh C. Sharma on India. At the last count, in December 2014, the number of mobile phone users in India was what? Mm. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, I'm just going to pull a figure out of the hat. I'm going to say...
I'll have to hurry you.
Sorry, 800 million.
Liet?
Oh my God.
Higher or lower?
I was going to go lower. I'll just say 750 then. Oh no, 600 million. Whatever, it doesn't matter.
The correct answer at the last count, 944 million.
What?
Yeah!
That's 2-0 to Katie.
Oh God.
I've got 5 questions, but we may not need them.
Okay, can we just say Katie's won and not torture me?
So, on page 72, there's a great feature about the history of the Batmobile ahead of, I think, the new video game Arkham Knight, which is out on June 23rd. The Batmobile first appeared in Detective Comics number 48. What year did the Batmobile first appear?
I don't know.
So that's looking for the first year the Batmobile appeared in print.
I have no idea.
Leah, I'll give you the first refusal.
I refuse. I have no idea when Batman began. I feel like
Take
I want to say...
Take a guess. You've seen old Batman comics.
Yeah, but my version of old might be different from yours.
Okay, Katie, what do you think?
I'm going to go with 1982.
See, I would... I'm going to put...
Batman 48. Detective Comics 48. Sorry.
I'm going to just say... What did you say?
1982.
I'm going to say 1981.
So that's lower. The correct answer is 1941.
Oh my God. Okay, so that's you're finding this very stressful.
So that's 2-1 to Katie. This is from an article about how to achieve paper plane glory, which is how to make an excellent paper plane. As you well know, the record for the longest paper plane flight is held by TV producer John Collins, who made the record of February 26th at McKellen Air Force Base with his plane Suzanne. How far did the plane fly?
I'm going to say...
Was it windy?
It's indoors, and it's in metres.
It's indoors, in metres.
Okay, closest correct answer.
Okay, oh, I'm going to guess 25 metres.
Liet?
30.
This is game theory here rather than a genuine attempt. The correct answer is 69.14 metres.
Oh my goodness.
You should have seen what my original guess was. It was huge, by the way. It was along the lines of 50 million tons of phosphorus.
I was thinking of a swimming pool and I was thinking, I bet it couldn't fly further than a swimming pool.
I was just picturing it soaring over the Grand Canyon for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, this is now a decider. 2-2. Okay, final question.
I don't like it.
This month in Wired UK, we have an excellent feature on the design history of the Apple Watch by David Pearce.
Yeah.
It's a great piece. Everyone should read it. One of the details in there is that obviously comparing the Apple Watch to the luxury watch industry, which generates a lot of money every year. In dollars, how much money, I guess revenue, it is revenue, does the luxury watch industry generate?
Oh God.
Every year.
Okay. How much is an average luxury watch? £10,000? Is that a reasonable estimate?
Sure.
Can we use calculators?
The Apple Watch starts at £8,000.
Okay. I reckon there'll be more then.
Every year, the whole industry.
The whole.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Watch
I'm just trying to work out the base price of the average.
Unless you know how many
watches
were sold every year.
This might not
help you.
Okay, yeah. It's not precise methodology, I will admit. But
at least you've got methodology.
I'm making up some statistics.
I think that's
how much is each watch? How many are sold a year?
Okay. Okay. What do you think? I need to hurry.
Okay, 10,000. I'm going to guess, say, £10,000 for a watch. And I'm going to say 100,000 are sold. No, way more than that. Okay. sorry, Michael. I'm going to guess it's worth 100 million a year.
The luxury watch industry is worth 100 million.
No, okay.
Well, why do you make a second guess ourselves?
100 million. I have to take your answer.
No. I don't want to
say the same thing.
Come on.
No, it's not worth anything near that.
I need an answer. The luxury watch industry.
52 million.
Annual revenue.
I was going to say 100.
Okay. Leah says 52.
That's not fair. I was only bullied into
Katie.
This.
Okay, I'm going to say it's worth something like 30 million.
I feel like it's higher. I feel like he was messing with us.
The podcast hasn't been this alive in years.
I need a shower.
2-2. We've got to get out of here because we've got work to do. Liat says 52 million. Katie says 30 million. The actual revenue annually of the luxury watch industry, 20 billion.
Yay!
What?
No, I missed you. I should have trusted my 50 million phosphorus so Liat, tons instinct because I was gonna go 100 billion.
I should have stuck with 100 million.
Liat is the podcast quiz champion.
Well done, Liat.
I wouldn't really call that a champion.
Week one. First in an endless series of despair. All of these questions and answers from Wired. June's 2015 edition, out now on the newsstands.
Please don't judge us.
I think we've all learnt our lesson, which is we need to revise hard next time.
Also, just don't say numbers that pop into your head because they sound nice.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.